And what we always do in the class is kind of go through some of the lessons that are recommended by the church, and we will be in Hebrews 5 today, actually part of chapter 4, so you might turn there ahead of time. And then I was in New Jersey last week and heard a rumor that you had some presidential candidates here. So this last half, about a third, I'm going to cover some things that I think are the so what question after you've had a chance to hear some of these candidates about the Christian vote. And so I think that will be really practical and helpful and as a kind of a good follow-up to what many of you had a chance to hear. And if you weren't there to hear it or to see it, it's now online. So if you wanted to follow that, that is something. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. But turn with me, if you would, to Hebrews. Actually, the last part of chapter 4, as Pastor Graham mentioned today, the chapter headings and divisions were not in the original. They were actually done by a Frenchman who actually did a lot of this when he was traveling on his horse, they found. And I think every once in a while the horse stumbled, because really, if you wanted to divide chapter 5, it should begin with chapter 4, verse 14, because this is a whole section here on the high priest. So we're going to begin there. And just as an introduction, we see that here, once again, the author, many people believe it's Luke, some people think it's Paul or Apollos, but I think Luke makes the most sense, uses some language from the Old Testament system of priests and sacrifices to now talk about the role of Jesus Christ. And we can now today say that because of Jesus, we experience forgiveness from God the Father. We also have access to the throne of grace, which he writes about here, and we can see that that is available to everyone, whereas that was available to an Old Testament believer once a year during that Day of Atonement. And so we're going to begin in chapter 4 real quickly and look at verses 14 to 16, and we see here, "Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who, in every respect, has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." And so here the author makes it very clear that we find ourselves in a very different set of circumstances. First of all, we'll see today that Jesus is the great high priest. A little bit later we'll see he's also the sacrifice, and a little bit later we'll also see that he is the king. So we see the various roles of Jesus. But here, even though he's a great high priest, immediately the author reminds us that he can sympathize with our weakness. Don't you hate to be with somebody that seems just perfect? I mean, we know that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, but if you're around somebody that just seems always to do the right thing, is always perfect, you kind of go, well, they really have no idea what my life is like. Even as we'll talk about later with some of these candidates, even the other day, I think it was Bernie Sanders said, you know, everybody but me up here is either a millionaire or a billionaire. And, you know, I thought, well, I can't relate to some of those people as well. But the concept here is the great high priest, he was supposed to be an individual who is almost sinless, who was going to then atone for the sin of the rest of Israel. But here, this is a great high priest that can sympathize with our weakness. Although he never sinned, we're going to see in just a minute, he was tempted and understands temptation. And so because of that, even though he is a high priest, even though Jesus was sinless, we can approach the throne of grace with confidence. Martin Luther, and sometimes his theology wasn't perfect, but I love Martin Luther one time said, we can sin boldly. I don't recommend it, but you know, the point he was making is that even in your sin, even in your failings, even in your temptation, even in your weakness, we can have confidence. And this is something which now we're going to see is something very different than an Old Testament believer might have experienced. Recognize that the author here is writing in large part to individuals who were Jewish, who had converted to Christianity. So they still have sometimes Old Testament baggage, but certainly Old Testament memories that help them understand that. And here you have this high priestly ministry of Jesus, which achieved for the believers what Israel never actually had. We have immediate access to God. We have immediate access to our Father. If you right now say, you know, I feel cut off from God, you can pray right now, even as we are sitting here and have access to Him. And that was something completely foreign to the life of an Old Testament believer. We have access to what before was off limits to those in this case. And so for just a minute, I'm going to take you back to the Old Testament. This is going to be Old Testament 101 for just a minute and the sacrificial ideas. But there, we are invited to occupy the Holy of Holies, offering daily prayers of thanksgiving and repentance. And it says that we can have confidence. And I love that. It says we can draw near. In the Greek, it's in the present tense. It's not you can someday do that or occasionally can. It's in the present tense. Right now, like I said, at this very moment, you can come to God when a need arises. And that is really good. We also begin to see that Jesus, because of this, helps us with our temptations. He can sympathize with our weakness and our temptations. It says that He was tempted to sin. And when we do that, we can also see that, of course, He actually dealt with that sin, that temptation by not sinning, I guess I should say. And so we see this in Hebrews 4, verse 14, but go right a little bit. Pastor Graham has been taking us through James, so go to James 1, verses 13 and following, because here, when James is writing, the half-brother of Jesus, he reminds us of how temptation can overtake us very easily and how it takes place. And in verse 13, he says, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, for He Himself tempts no one." Verse 14. But each person is tempted when he is lured. So first you have the look, then you have the lure, then he's enticed by his own desire. So now you have the look and then the lust and the things of that nature. Then that desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. So now then you have the conception, and then you have the birth. This is a reminder that some of those earlier patterns are ones that Jesus actually experienced. Where there are times when Jesus saw the lust of the eyes. There are times when Jesus might have felt desire. We see this in the temptation. And after 40 days, he was hungry. So Satan knows, here's how I can get to him right off the bat. I can tempt him with food. And so he obviously had a desire for food, but he did not sin. Then he tempts him with, well, throw yourself off and get some kind of acknowledgement, accolades. You're obscure right now, but just imagine if you were to throw yourself off of the high part of the temple here or some precipice and save yourself, then you could actually get more attention. And again, he may have felt the desire. He may have felt the lure of that a little bit. Jesus finally then is approached by Satan with the greatest of all, and that is, if you will just bow down, I will give you all the kingdoms of the earth. But never did he actually give birth to sin. But he felt those earlier parts of temptation, the ones that we feel. And then, of course, sin gives forth death. And so here it's a reminder that Jesus himself indeed felt the temptation, but he was able to not sin. And I think James chapter 1, verses 13 and 15 reminds us that when we feel temptation, even though there is a tendency in our culture to say, if you feel the temptation, you have to act on it. If you have this desire, you need to act on it. Have you heard that all the time? Here it says you feel that desire, but you can go the other way. Jesus did, and we have the power to do so. So first of all, he reminds us that Jesus is a high priest, but he's not just a high priest, he's also the sacrifice. Turn with me to chapter 5 and look at verses 1 to 4. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. And now we're going to look at two different priests. One is Aaron, the other is Melchizedek. But here it is a reminder once again that Jesus is not just a priest, but he also is the priest and the sacrifice. An interesting idea here. The Old Testament priesthood was really established by God, and it was a way in which those Old Testament believers who sinned would eventually have atonement for their sin. And so the priests received the people's daily sacrifices and offered them in the temple. And this, of course, was to appeal to God's grace and mercy. But then once a year, you would have a time when the high priest would go behind the temple veil to the Holy of Holies on behalf of himself and the people. Now, you may have heard the story, and there seems to be some evidence of that, that when he would do that, he'd have to walk a little funny because he had a rope tied to his leg. You ever heard the story? Because there was a fear that if indeed that sacrifice was not acceptable, that he would be struck down, so they would pull him back out by a rope. You can see why sometimes being high priest is not necessarily the job that everybody looked for, right? And certainly you would make sure that you had gone through daily sacrifices and prayed to the Lord God Yahweh Almighty that you would not be struck dead. So in that Holy of Holies, he would present a sin offering of atonement, which then provided for the ceremonial cleansing of the entire nation. And if you're taking some notes, you might put down Leviticus 16. If I had a little more time, I would turn to that, but I think you can look it up a little bit later, be part of your quiet time, just to sort of look at what was actually available to them at that time. Now, these are some diagrams. These are not actual pictures from the Old Testament, but these are some diagrams of people thinking of what this must have looked like. And here on the left-hand side, you can probably see that, I guess we can't see the thing very well, but you have the giving of that sin offering by the high priest. And this was to be done once a year. And so this was the Day of Atonement. You know, today we talk about Yom Kippur and things like that. And here you can see the other people gathering outside of the temple. And so there were kind of three stages, if you will, for what actually would take place. Because first of all, all worshipers, those ones outside, could approach the outer limits of the sanctuary. So you could actually get that far into the sanctuary, but then the ordinary priests, could then approach the altar. But there was only one, and that was the high priest, who once a year could actually go to that holy place. Now, if you're thinking about this from the Old Testament Jewish perspective, they already recognized the hierarchy. We've got the high priest, we've got the priests, and we've got the rest. And we recognize where we can go in the temple. When Jesus died, what happened to the veil in the temple? Okay, so no longer is there a separation. And so Jesus is actually better than the high priest. If we've already seen, he's better than a priest, he's better than all of the things that we've talked about here, better than the Old Testament, because Jesus is the high priest, he is also the sacrifice, he is there all the time, and we can approach him in a way that only one man in all of Israel could do once a year. I hope that makes you feel more privileged, right? What one man, the holiest man, the high priest, could do once a year, you can do right now sitting where you are, if indeed you've accepted Jesus Christ. So this, of course, raises a couple of questions that I've seen. The first, is Jesus an acceptable sacrifice? And of course, the writer of Hebrews is saying he is fully acceptable in God's eyes, in the Father's eyes. So we don't have to look for another sacrifice. This is the problem with a lot of cults. It's the Bible and something else. It's Jesus and something else. There's always something added to the full acceptable sacrifice of Jesus. And one of the ways to identify a cult is when they use the word and. It's the Bible and. Okay, you know, it's Jesus and. And then you can begin to recognize, because this is a fully acceptable sacrifice to the Father. Okay, well, does Jesus then have compassion for us that a high priest would have for the people? And I think we just saw that a minute ago. Verse 2, you can put that in your notes. For he himself is beset with weakness. He's a high priest, but he understands our weaknesses. And again, that's different than a lot of other religions. Either there's this belief that God is totally unknowable and he is distant, and that is certainly the view of Islam. I've spent a lot of time these last 2 weeks talking about Islam, since that's a talk almost everybody wants me to give these days, Islam or ISIS or whatever. And you know, you can't even really have a relationship with Allah. He is distant. He is unknowable. He reveals himself through his holy prophet, through his holy book of the Quran, or through an angel, but he is unknowable. Or he is part of the great oneness of the universe, but again, he's not personal. That's the Eastern religions. But again, we can see that we have a high priest who still, nevertheless, understands our weakness. and that is the case. Well, let's keep it moving because we want to get to some of the other application points. In verse 5 to 10, we now see that he is a priest. He's a sacrifice. If you're making a list, he's one more. He is king. And we just ended by talking about Aaron in verse 4. Now we talk about Melchizedek, and that is very important. Verse 5. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." And he says also in another place, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, Melchizedek is not somebody we know a great deal about. If you have your Bible open, you might go right to a minute, and you can see he's mentioned a little bit more in Hebrews 7, verse 1. Or if you go left all the way to Genesis 14, we run into him. But let me talk about why this is the case. Because up until now, he's talked about Aaron, the priest. Why Melchizedek? I think there's a very good reason. First of all, we see the qualifications of a priest that are listed. We went through a few of those. And now Jesus is declared a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And of course, the priesthood, as I just pointed out, is a divine vocation. It was established by God. It's not a human institution. And so we just saw for a moment that Aaron is, when we think about it, he's the first of the high priests. He's the George Washington, if you will. He is the beginning of the priestly Levites. But instead, the writer here takes us to another, and that is Melchizedek. And the reason for that is he now takes us not just to Aaron, but he takes us even further back to Abraham. Then these quotes are actually from Psalm 110. You might put in your notes Psalm 110. This would be something else you might want to look at during our quiet time this week. But it introduces us to the idea that Jesus is a priest and a king. Well, once we see that, we see why the writer talks about Melchizedek, because Melchizedek was the king of Salem. Don't have too many examples of that. As a matter of fact, that may be the only example in the Old Testament of both a king and a priest. Those were separate entities, right? And it is interesting that later on when Jesus is being challenged by the Pharisees, they're saying, you know, who are you? You know, because you're making these kinds of claims. It's obvious that you're not a king. It's obvious that you're not the high priest. So because you're making these claims, you must have been one of the other three. And that is, you must have been what? The Messiah. Well, now the writer of Hebrews brings them all together. Jesus is the Messiah, but he's also the king, and he's also the high priest. Isn't that amazing? And so Melchizedek is an answer to that question, because just as Melchizedek was a king of Salem, but he's also the priest of the Most High God we see in Genesis 14. And so we see that characteristic as well. Now, the whole priesthood of Jesus is something we're going to run into a little bit more as we make our way through the book of Hebrews. So that's going to be discussed in later chapters. But let me just mention, for now, at least, the author affirms two very important prerequisites. And if you're taking notes, here they are. The first, he's appointed by God. He didn't appoint himself. God appointed him, God the Father. So we see the relationship between God the Father and God the Son. And number two, he experiences genuine humanity. Again, this is an attempt maybe to belabor the obvious, but he is a high priest appointed by God, but he also lived in a human world, and because of that can experience our weakness. This was a very helpful book, which is almost an antidote to what began to unfold in the first century, and that was what was called Gnosticism. If you want to know a lot about Gnosticism, read the Da Vinci Code. Gnosticism runs all the way through that popular book. But Gnosticism in that day was the idea that they had trouble with this Greek kind of mindset that God could be human because the world is supposed to be evil. So they believed that Jesus was divine, but they didn't believe that Jesus was human. And here it shows that he was appointed by God, but he experienced genuine humanity. And now let's go look at verse 7. This was something that was very difficult for the Gnostics to accept. And this is why this book was so helpful in pushing that back. because it says while Jesus lived on this earth, he cried out in pain and he wept in sorrow. Have you ever had pain? You ever had sorrow? Of course. So he can understand that. It also says that he offered up these priestly prayers to God, asked God to work in his life. He honored God, and of course Jesus rose from the grave and in that sense conquered the grave, but he actually had humanity. So first in verse 7, we have a clear understanding that in those days he'd offered up prayers and supplications, but also loud cries and tears. We see in verse 8 then, though he was God's son, he learned trusting and obedience. Some have thought that when it says he was a son, obviously he was the son of God, but Jesus was also the son of who? Joseph. Have you ever wondered about that? I mean, the years are what are oftentimes referred to as the last or lost years of Jesus. You know, we see him at age 12 and then we see him at age probably 30-something. Some people think it might have been as much as 31 to 33. What about that? He's working in a carpenter's workshop. You know, and if you've ever been to Nazareth, those of us that have had a tour of Israel, you go there and go, not much here. You know, this is where it all happened. And this is where he went to synagogue and he learned obedience there as well. Experienced genuine humanity. It's possible he may have gotten splinters. And certainly that he got tired. For all sorts of things because he was human like us. Fully God, fully human. And then verse 9, we see one more aspect of that. He was made perfect and then is the source of salvation for us that believe. So again, the focus here is he's the great high priest, he is the sacrifice, and he is king. And so we can begin to see that that leads to the last section here before we get into some other application points on what that should mean to us as believers. And here we have another one of those warning passages, and the writer gives us many of those in verses 11 and following. We see this. About this, we have much to say, and it is hard to explain since you have become dull of hearing. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic principles of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food, for everyone who lives on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness since he is a child. But solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. And here, once again, a reminder of the fact that they were still spiritually immature. He says that they'd become dull of hearing. And I say, as you can see on the screen here, that was probably a temptation in that day. It is a major temptation for us today, isn't it? We have so many more distractions. If it was possible in the first century to become dull of hearing, imagine now what it's like to actually sometimes not hear the Lord in the cacophony of voices and sounds and beeps and buzzes and everything that are part of our life in the 21st century. Even as I was going over this again this morning, I was thinking, our house is so quiet. I mean, it's so quiet that your ears almost kind of ring a little bit. You know what that's like? I mean, it's so quiet that I could hear the clock going tick, tick, tick. A clock's on the other side of the room. And I thought, how rare it is that we have quiet in our lives anymore. And so it's easy to become dull of hearing. And I'm going to come back to an application point in just a minute. But if this was a true warning to believers in the first century, I think it's an even more significant warning in the 21st century. Then it refers to this idea of the oracles of God. You might say, what's that all about? Well, that was a phrase used in the Old Testament to really talk about divine revelation. When you hear oracles today, you sometimes think of some of the science fiction stuff or whatever, but that's what it was. And again, the concept is that by now you've been fed enough, you should be feeding other people. But you're still like a child going, you know, still wanting to be fed. You're still on milk and you should be in meat. And so this is this idea that you should be actually involved in taking solid food. One of the things I love about the examine class is most of us in this room have been Christians a long time. So, you know, we're not handing out milk bottles at the back of the room and burping you as you leave. You know, we're giving you some pretty heavy stuff sometimes. And I've had some of you say, I know I was sitting down because some of that went right over my head, you know. But my idea is that you're mature believers now. I'm going to give you some things maybe you've never heard in a class before. And I hope you appreciate that. But one of the things we're going to see this getting us into is the last part of chapter 5 and into chapter 6 raises the biggest question that we have right now sometimes in the church. And that is, let's look at this ring here. On one side we have the Armenians. And the Armenians are convinced that these verses, especially as we get into chapter 6, prove that you can lose your salvation. And because it says there's falling away, and we're going to get into a lot more of that next time, because there is a natural chapter break between 5 and 6, so we'll cover some of that next time. And over here on the other side of the ring are the Calvinists that are convinced that, you know, you can't lose your salvation because we believe in eternal security. So if somebody strays, it means that they weren't Christians in the first place, that they walked an aisle, they were baptized, they said they were Christians, but they were never really saved. You ever had a problem with that? I have. And those of us who teach in seminary classes hear it all the time. That one and predestination and a few others are the biggies that everybody argues with. Well, I wanted to give you some advanced notice, but Joseph Dillo, Jody Dillo actually graduated from Dallas Seminary, I've known him for decades, wrote this book called The Reign of Servant Kings. And it's a very thick book, and I'll take us through a little bit of that next week. But his argument is the Armenians aren't right and the Calvinists aren't right. What? Well, the Calvinists are half right, and the Armenians are half right. The Calvinists are right in that there is eternal security. You know, once saved, always saved. You know, if indeed you are saved eternally, then that's eternal. But the Armenians are saying you can fall away, but what he means is they fall away in terms of their gifts and their rewards at the Bema Seat of Christ. And I'll take you through some of that next time, but it's, I think, a very powerful passage, because this one is used all the time. You can go in right now and type in words like eternal security, and you'll see all sorts of Armenians say, well, these passages right here show that you lose your salvation. You know, and I run into that all the time. Matter of fact, Friday night I was with the daughter of Charles Stanley. Many of you know Charles Stanley, and Charles Stanley and his son Andy Stanley have written, I think, the definitive book on eternal security. And you can type in Charles Stanley and eternal security, or Charles Stanley lose your salvation. You're going to, you know, if you do a Google search, it'll go poof. I mean, they say all sorts of nasty things about Charles Stanley because they use this verse, but I think there's a better answer to it. So I wanted to give you a preview of coming attractions so that if you ever run into somebody that's absolutely convinced that you can lose your salvation based upon what we've just looked at and the other verses we'll look at next time, there's a much better answer. And that simply is, yes, you could lose the rewards that you would get in heaven. You know, there are going to be some individuals, when they look at all their works, they just all get burned up. Right? Isn't that what the scriptures say? You're kind of a fire sale Christian. That's all you got, you know? And, you know, you're kind of in the distance. You're in those cheap seats that Pastor Graham was talking about, rather than the chief seats, you know? And so we want to be in the chief seats, not in the cheap seats, right? In heaven. And so, again, I think that's a fairly quick answer to that, and we'll get into that more next week. Verse 13, the word of righteousness is a phrase that speaks to, again, the moral choices that we make. It applies to kind of the ethical decisions. And this is one of the places where the word discernment shows up in the New Testament, because we are to have discernment. We have all sorts of people today quoting Matthew 7:1 out of context. Judge not, that you might be judged. So you're not ever supposed to make a moral judgment. Is that what what Jesus is saying? No, of course not. But here, we actually are told to have discernment, to make wise choices and to have discernment. And in verse 14, it even refers to the word trained discernment. And that is an individual that is actually taking solid food, not milk. He or she can make wise decisions about what is right and what is wrong, able to distinguish between God's voice, which is good, and the enemy's voice, which is bad. And that's what we should be calling for people that are mature Christians. So as we come to an end here, for those who want to take some notes, I thought we finished now 5 chapters of Hebrews, and I think we have 5 lessons that we can apply. Lesson number 1 we picked out in chapter 1, and that is not to drift in the Christian life. I think it's a temptation for those of us that are mature Christians after a while. We kind of go, oh, okay, I've heard this before. We've gone through the book of Hebrews, you know, heard Pastor Graham preach on it. You know, I went through basic youth conflicts or, you know, Bible study fellowship or whatever, you know, I've heard. So we kind of sometimes can drift. We kind of put our Christianity in autopilot and kind of just drift away. So first of all, we should not drift in the Christian life. Second of all, we also saw the author in one of the earlier chapters say that we should not neglect this great salvation. Don't take it for granted. It's easy sometimes to take it for granted. You became a Christian at the age of 5 and you're in your 60s now and you go, that was a long time ago. I'm kind of taking for granted my salvation. But he says, don't take for granted your great salvation. Then we saw last time even the idea that don't have a hardened heart. Don't be like Pharaoh. Don't get to the point where you're just so hardened about those issues. Certainly have those. And then do not let your ears grow dull. Did you see this? Don't get dull of hearing and do not lose your drive to maturity. Seems to me that, again, this is a book that is so applicable to those of us that have been Christians for a long period of time. Because sometimes it is very easy for us to just sort of drift. Easy for us to take for granted our salvation. Very easy for us to say, yeah, I've heard that before. You know, that's, you know, I've actually preached on that, or I've taught on that, or, you know, Kay Arthur's taught on it. I've heard this one before, and I heard Chuck Swindoll speak on it, and okay, I don't need to hear anymore from that passage. You know, I know that one. Or I memorized that in Awana's years ago, and it's kind of already in my, you know, there's nothing else you can teach me of that passage, because I've gone over it time and time again. And so again, there is a real danger that I do believe we could run into of becoming dull of hearing or maybe no longer driving and striving towards maturity. And if you're new in the class, I think you've already heard me say, we cover some pretty controversial things in here. We cover some pretty heavy stuff. In some respects, I wish that either Southwestern Baptist Seminary or Dallas Seminary could give you a certificate, because some of the stuff you're getting is just the kind of stuff that we would give you in a seminary class. And if nothing else, I hope you appreciate the fact that we don't treat you like babies. We're not handing out milk bottles. We're giving you some of the meat of the Word. With that as background, in the next couple of minutes, I wanted to come back to something that happened Sunday night. And as I said, for those of you who just walked in, heard a rumor that you had some presidential candidates here last Sunday. And I thought for just a minute I might give you some application points, some so what, now that you've learned some of that. And I've got some pictures there of Ted Cruz and thanks Rick Santorum and Jeb Bush and Ben Carson and Mike Huckabee and Carly Fiorina. We had Ben Carson on this week on the program, and I had Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, many of these individuals in the past, so I've gotten to know them a little bit. But I thought it would be good for just a minute to talk about what you might want to do now that you know a little bit more. And the first thing is I think if you're looking at Scripture, is to recognize that we have both a citizenship in heaven and on earth. And that is that I have some Christians say, well, you know, my citizenship is in heaven. And Philippians 3:20 says that. You know, we're heaven-bound individuals. But, you know, in John 17, which we looked at this last spring, he also says that we're to what? Be in the world, but not of the world. And I think we have a citizenship both in heaven and on earth. And I think it's really important for us during, as we get into this election season. And I might just mention, by the way, that a week from this Tuesday, we do get a chance to vote for 6 different propositions on the ballot. And so those are very important. I mean, they have everything to do with hunting and fishing and the various kinds of whether or not you could increase your homestead allowance and whether we would actually tax those kinds of things. There's some really important issues on the proposition. But a year from now, we're going to have some really important elections, aren't we? I think it's going to be important to think about those. And a lot of people say, well, you know, we need to keep the church and state separate. And I thought it was interesting. On Channel 8 News, it was very interesting. They asked Pastor Graham, you know, do you think it's appropriate for the church to get involved in a politics? And he says, I think it's absolutely essential that Christians and the church get involved. But part of it is, I think, a misunderstanding of the word church. And Pastor Graham talked about that even today. The church scattered, the church gathered. When we talk about the church scattered or the church being the body of Christ, of course we're supposed to be good as citizens, as salt and light. We're supposed to be salt and light. We're to be ambassadors. As individuals, we have that. Now, if we're talking about the institution of the church, like Prestonwood Baptist Church, we recognize that Jesus was asked about that. He said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, render unto God the things that are God's. I mean, there's a difference, obviously, between ecclesiastical authority or church authority and political authority. But I think Christians certainly have a responsibility to get involved, and we have some very good passages to illustrate that. Romans 13, verses 1 through 7. I'll just skip just to 1 and 7. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Then a series of verses at the end, then Paul says, render all to what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. And I think the very least we could say is the Bible teaches, first of all, that God establishes government. It's not something we've come up with. God has established the institution of government, and that would be to rule over the nations. And in our particular situation, our government is a government of the people and by the people, and really for the people, and that means God put us in charge. A Christian in China right now doesn't have the kind of authority and responsibility that I think we have. A Christian in Venezuela does not have the same kind of authority and opportunity that we have. But God has given us the vote, and I believe that that is going to be important. So I think our first and most fundamental right is the right to vote. And we elect leaders who are then our representatives in government. And I think also it would also imply that we should be good citizens. You know, we have a civic duty to be involved. For example, jury duty. Yeah, I've had some Christians say, oh, I never want to get on jury duty. And I'm thinking, no, I want you on jury duty. If you ever go to trial, would you like to have Christians on the jury? You bet you would, yes. I just don't think we are the ones that should be walking away from jury duty. Now, granted, I've been on juries 4 times, and I've been knocked off many more times. They see me coming. I remember one time during the voir dire, this one defense attorney stands up there and says, you know, I've actually been supporting and defending everything from the ACLU defendants to the National Organization of Women. Let me ask my first question. Mr. Anderson, she was going to get me off as fast as she could and did. But nevertheless, when we can serve on a jury duty, we should. And contacting our legislators. I think those are all parts of our civic responsibility. We go to 1 Peter. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. So I certainly see that we have a responsibility to obey those in authority. But we also are told to pray for those in authority. Paul says to Timothy, first of all, then I urge that entreaties and prayers and petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men for kings and all who are in authority, for that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. And so certainly we are to pray for those in authority. And I've said at least 16 people are in direct authority over you. I call them our key 16. Your president, have 9 members of the Supreme Court. We have 2 senators. You have a U.S. representative, then we have a governor and a state senator and a state representative. Those are 16 individuals. Now, if you want to add mayor, city council, school board, you know, that number gets larger. But, you know, I won't put anybody on the spot, but how many of you can say that you prayed for all 16 of those in the last week? Probably not many hands would go up, you know. And that's, I think, a responsibility that we have here as well. So we should obey those in authority, we should pray for those in authority, and we should vote for those in authority. And what about this idea of salt and light? You know, Jesus says you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? And so here he warns us that we are to be the salt of the earth, we are to be a preservative. But he also warned that there could be a time when the salt loses its savor. We get mixed with the impurities of the world and we're no longer useful. Or even when he says, you're light, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is heaven. The problem is sometimes we hide our light, don't we? Or we bury our talents. And that brings me to the issue of voting. How well have Christians actually dealt with this issue of voting? Have we buried our talents? Have we hidden our light? Well, in the last presidential election, this is what we found. And this information comes from George Barna, and I had George Barna and Gary Fraser on my radio program the other day. And so I've looked at these numbers. These are really solid numbers. If you look at individuals who are self-identified born-again Christians, they said they've had a born-again experience that's been meaningful in their life, and they believe they're saved by grace. You know, only God can separate sheep and goats, but that's a pretty good set of questions to determine whether or not somebody's born again. If you take that number, there are 90 million born-again Christians of voting age, 18 and older. Of that 90 million, 77 million of them are registered to vote, and only 51 million of them voted in the 2012 election. Let's put it a different way. There are 39 million eligible Christian voters that did not vote or were not registered to vote in 2012. With me on this? A third of them, that is 13 million, were not registered to vote. 26 million of them were registered but did not go to the polls. This afternoon, we're going to look at a football game. You can imagine there are going to be a few individuals that will be standing on the sidelines without a uniform on, right? And those are the ones that are not registered to vote. They're not going to get into the game for whatever reason. Broken foot, collarbone, whatever, okay? Then you have some other guys that are going to be sitting on the bench and they're never going to get in the game. Those are the ones registered to vote but never play, you know? And you recognize that the game is fought by the ones that are on the field. So this has become a really significant question. Now, there are groups, including the one I just mentioned by Gary Frazier and George Barna and others are involved with, that have been working really hard to begin to identify those 26 million who are registered to vote and challenge them to go out and vote next time. Now, you might say, well, I don't want just everybody to vote, right? Because some of them might vote wrong. Well, they have these massive databases that these people in Silicon Valley put together where they can say, this person who did not register to vote, we do know that they subscribe to World Magazine, or they have given to American Family Association, or they subscribe to Christianity Today, or they go to this church. In other words, you can find some of this out. And so they did this before in an election in the state of Alaska for a U.S. Senate race. And they identified all sorts of individuals and then challenged them with emails and even occasional phone calls to pledge that they would go out and vote that time. And as a result, they were able to win that election in Alaska. Now they want to roll this out for the entire country. But I think it does give us some opportunity. You may know some people right now. They may be family members. They may be people that you work with that are that 13 million that are not registered to vote. They're our kind of people. They agree with us. They believe in life. They believe in marriage. They believe in religious liberty. They believe in all sorts of things. And first of all, we need to get them put on a uniform. That's the first one, right? And then number two, we got to get those people that have a uniform to get into the game. Is that right? I'll keep the football analogy going for just a minute. But you might want to say, well, does it really make any difference? How many times have I heard people say, how important is one vote? Okay, let's just go back to the 2000 election. George W. Bush was elected by 527 votes in the state of Florida. Could it be any closer than that? That is the absolute closest election in American history. Well, what people forget is all the other close elections that happened that year as well. The 2000 Senate elections ended in a 50-50 tie. Do you remember this? 50 Republicans, 50 Democrats, until the senator from Vermont, Jim Jeffords, decided, no, I'm not a Republican, I'm independent, and then caucused with the Democrats. Okay, but up until that time, why is it always in Vermont? You know, it's now Bernie Sanders and Jim Jeffords, whatever. Okay. Then in the 2000 House elections, if you just shifted about 54, almost 5,500 votes in five districts, the Democrats would have been in charge rather than the Republicans. So you can see that we had really close elections. For someone to sit there and say, oh yeah, well those are still 527 votes. I could do you better. I've kept track of some of the closest elections in American history. Here's just two of them. This one was Penny Pullen. Penny Pullen and I used to do broadcasts on Moody Broadcasting, and she was a representative in the Illinois State Legislature. And when she ran that time, they concluded that the election was a draw. Now, there were some voter irregularities. In Chicago, they have people that sometimes vote, you know, and I don't think you should be voting unless, you know, no voting without respiration. But anyway, you know, they do, so there were some voter irregularities in there. So anyway, they finally just said, you know, we've got to call this a draw. We've got to call it a tie. And so Judge Francis Barth tossed a coin in the air, and Penny lost that election on a coin toss. Here's the rest of the story. That week in church, she went back. Nearly three dozen members of her own church said, oh, Penny, if I'd known this was an important election, I would have voted. I was out of town, and I didn't get an absentee ballot. Oh, I got home late, and I didn't think it made any difference. And if just one of the members of her church had voted for her, she'd still be serving, even to this day, in the Illinois State Legislature there in Springfield, Illinois. My other fun one is a city council election in Ohio. That's where William Crawford and Gene Miller both received an identical number of votes. That one didn't turn out so well in the Crawford family because William Crawford has two sons and neither of them voted in that election. One lives at home, the other lived across the street, one went to college. Did you imagine it must have been a little bit difficult in that Thanksgiving dinner? And so again, close votes, we've had a lot of them. We've had some close votes even here in the state of Texas. So what about this? The next presidential election. You know, you heard from some of the presidential candidates, and let's just inject a little bit of common sense here. It's pretty obvious that unless Republicans nominate, you know, just the most incompetent person in the world, the Republican candidate is going to win Texas. So in some respects, you know, getting out the vote for the presidential election is important, but it's not crucial. It's also true that unless, you know, the presumptive nominee right now is indicted on something, this Democratic nominee will win California and New York as well. We just sort of know that. The battleground states are going to be very different. And quite frankly, I think it is much easier to win as a Democrat than a Republican, because if you look at what I put down there, there are 18 states that have voted Democrat in the last 6 consecutive elections. And so there's no reason to believe that Oregon and Washington and California, New Jersey, New York, Maine, you can go Pennsylvania probably, and some of those won't probably vote Democratic again. And so the Democratic nominee, whoever he or she is, starts with 242 electoral votes, which means that that nominee then only has to find, what, 28 more. Well, that means you either win Florida, you win, or you win Ohio and Colorado, you win. So it's really easy right now because of the way the Electoral College is structured to win. And so, again, I think there's a real difference. And I'm not trying to be partisan here, but again, if you are pro-life, pro-family, you really are concerned about religious liberty, a couple of issues, you're not going to find a whole lot of home right now in the Democratic Party. That's just the way it is. You know, there are a few pro-life Democrats, but they're hard to find. And they aren't running at the national level. So that's, in some respects, you say, well, there's a little I can do to help the presidential election, maybe if I work in another state. But there are some things you could do in this state if you really wanted to get involved. And the first of these is to recognize that even in the state of Texas, we have 31 Texas Senate seats. The reality is that most of those senators are going to win again because you either have safe Republican seats or safe Democratic seats. Many of you have, maybe here's your state senator right now, Van Taylor, and he's going to win. There's no doubt about that. And you can go down this list. And so you say, well, are there any that are competitive where my involvement might make a difference? Well, it turns out that Tuesday I was actually at an event where one of the other speakers was Connie Burton. She represents the 10th district. That is the closest you have to a true purple state. Who represented that before? Wendy Davis. Anybody know who Wendy Davis is? Okay. About as pro-abortion as you can get. And now it's represented by Connie Burton, who is pro-life. Okay, so there, that one is one that could go either way. And last time, before this last election, Wendy Davis was the state senator. Now Connie Burton is the state senator. So if you said, okay, I'd maybe like to help on election over there in Fort Worth, that one is important. Many of these others, again, are the case. When you get to the House, same sort of thing. We have 5 members of Prestonwood that are actually serving in the legislature right now. And they're all probably going to win again. I mean, there's no reason to believe that Jeff Leach and we go down, you know, Ron Simmons and all them are going to win again. And you say, okay, you know, is there any race there? Well, maybe some people are starting to get behind Jody Loppenberg in the 86th district? Because there may be a challenge there. So there's a few places where you could get involved where your involvement would make a difference. Because there's a tendency to say, well, you know, our state's Republican, our state is, you know, general, we got pretty much pro-life legislators and pro-life governors and lieutenant governors, and so, you know, I can sit back. Well, there's some places where you could put a little bit of time and energy in, and that might make a difference. So just off the top of my head, I just wanted you to recognize that there's a place for you if you wanted to get involved. The other thing, as I mentioned just a minute ago before we wind down here, is it's really important to make sure that you have individuals that are registered to vote. And you might say, well, I think I'm registered to vote. You know, I moved. Suzanne and I just moved this last year. Some of us have moved around. Make sure that you are. For some of us, make sure your kids are, because sometimes they don't change it. And there's a way you get on this online there and actually see if you're registered to vote. Or if you know a coworker and some of the basic numbers, you could see if he or she is registered to vote and say, I don't think you're registered to vote. Yeah, you caught me. You know, those are some ways in which you can very quickly, as a good citizen, encourage people to be registered to vote. You might say, well, where do I find information about these candidates? Because pretty soon they're going to be asking for my donations, or they're going to be asking for my vote. Well, it turns out, and this is a map from the family policy groups. Focus on the Family years ago put together these family policy groups, and we have one here. It's called Texas Values. It's out of Austin, and Jonathan Sines runs it. And you can go to that map. This is at Family Research Council, frc.org. Or you just type in family policy groups, it'll surface, or go to Focus on the Family, family.org, you'll find it there. And you can click on your state, and you click on it there, it gives you the names and addresses and everything. They're producing voter guides and all sorts of other materials so that you can vote intelligently about those candidates. And many of the states, Ohio and Texas in particular, they go all the way down the ballot. In Ohio, it's probably the best one I've ever seen. I mean, they give you ratings on everybody from the president all the way to dog catcher. I have never seen more. And they rate even the judges and all sorts of individuals, city council. It's a very extensive amount that Phil Burris does up there in Ohio. I want to try to develop more of that in Texas because most of us know we're going to vote on the first top two or three. But it's when you get down here to the judges and city council, you don't know as much. And they are able to either get their voting guides or in some cases they've been able to track down and say, well, this particular candidate is endorsed by ACLU, a National Organization of Women, National Abortion Rights League. This group is endorsed by Eagle Forum, Concerned Women for America, Member Family Association. So even though they didn't answer it, we have a pretty good idea of where they stand on the issues, right? So again, those are resources that are available to you. And I've gone just a little bit over time, but I also wanted to mention that one of the things we're going to do here at Prestonwood is develop a culture impact team. Matter of fact, there's a meeting at noon tomorrow about that, and I was invited to it, and we'll find out more about this, where then we could actually pull together some of this information and make it available to you. So the good news is that the church recognizes that it isn't wrong for churches to address these political issues. As a matter of fact, maybe it's exactly what we as believers need to do. So if nothing else, I hope that that gave you a little bit of information, not only about the book of Hebrews, but maybe a little bit of a follow-up to that great presidential forum that we had on Sunday. Parker?